We're well and truly locked in. Locked in on Anzac Day, and we're going on a sort of magic mystery tour back to 1915-16. This today is Anzac Day, which I suppose I'll be boring and say Anzac Day was the day that, on the 25th, when troops from Australia and New Zealand landed in the wrong place on the Gallipoli Peninsula and were literally massacred. Has somebody come here? I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's okay.
And it's always marked in New Zealand. I think on the news tonight there's a clip showing the war memorial in Wellington with the Easter. It's usually about Easter in New Zealand with the Anzac performance that takes place at that time. So we've chosen this day for it. In London and elsewhere in the country, there are going to be similar ceremonies taking place to mark this occasion. Well, I've very fortunately been able to get Sean, who is the Director of Studies at the Royal Military Academy. I've done a very poor job of setting the scene, but Sean's going to set the scene for this period of war from after Gallipoli right through till 1919. So over to you, Sean.
Thank you, Murray, and I feel very honoured to be here. And in many ways, it shouldn't be me. It should be a short, stumpy, very choleric New Zealander called Chris Pugsley, who we were lucky enough to have working at Sandhurst for just over a decade, but he very foolishly bought a beach house somewhere on the South Island of New Zealand and decided to go there about 3 months ago. I don't understand it. He works for the MOD where, as you know, the salaries are huge and the conditions are wonderful, so I don't know why he left. But he left me with this job. The First World War is probably the most puzzling war that any historian looks at. It's a war in which the narrow community of academic military historians, in which I don't really number myself, have one view, and the rest of the world has another. The rest of the world sees this war as a bloody and futile conflict, which broke the older world of Europe, which brought radical forces, some of which were very unpleasant, some of which were slightly more pleasant, into the fore, and which ushered in the modern age, for all that's worth. Academic historians take a different perspective. We see it as being a brilliant contest by a superb British army led by shrewd people such as Field Marshal Haig, surmounting the little problem of the German army and emerging triumphant in August 1918. And we're very frustrated with you guys. We think you should get with the plot, read a few really boring books with footnotes, not this sort of stuff here, and actually realise what a great war it really was. Now, I've been pondering why that gap exists, and I was talking about it before the launch with several people. And for my money, the reality is that we still remember this war. This war still sits in our folklore. It's too terrible for us to process as a rational event which we bring dispassion to. Most people get angry when they talk about this war. And do you know what? Historians also get angry because they won't listen to you, which is why they get more extreme in their revisionist ideas. And if you think the First World War was vicious and futile, it had grandeur. If you look at the conflicts between military historians on it, they have little grandeur, but certainly a lot of viciousness and futility in the way they knock each other's ideas about. Lions led by donkeys, I suppose, is the way most of us think about this war. A war fought by brave working-class soldiers, dominated by technology, led by commanders who thought of the speed of the 19th century and not the speed of the emerging 20th century, led by commanders who didn't have the compassion to realise what they were doing to their soldiers, and in particular the case of the British Army, led by generals who were all upper-class public school idiots with peculiar moustaches. But there is some truth to that. There's also another, a lot of truth with a different way of looking at this war. That this war was a technological bridgehead between an older and a newer form of technology. It was a war which ushered in technology, firepower of huge amounts. It was a war that exploited the industrial might of the countries involved. And least we forget it, it was a war which tapped into intense patriotism. And that's one of the things that comes out in Murray's book, the two chief protagonists. These are patriotic young men who go off to war. And anyone who's looked at the tombstones in the big war graves of Flanders will notice that there were very, very few epitaphs that said, this is all futile and we hated it and we lost our son. They're all patriotic, they're all chosen by the nearest relative to the fallen soldier. This is a war fought by willing volunteers, as far as most British and most New Zealand soldiers are concerned. 70% of the New Zealand soldiers that served in this war were volunteers. So it's a complicated war to understand. And because it's technologically so dynamic, and I use the word dynamic deliberately, it's not a war of stupid generals doing the same thing again and again. It's a war of very bright generals and very bright armies, massively improving, but sadly both sides are improving at the same time. One of the wisest strategies is always to fight the people armed with bananas, because that way you can win smoothly, quickly and easily, and then you can oppress your enemy. First World War, you have a match of equals, equal determination, equal technology, ingenuity that almost matched each other. So every successful change and move and innovation of the attacker was matched by successful moves and innovations of the defender. A terrible, terrible conundrum, of which the only way out of it was for somebody to say, roughly in the end of September 1914, why don't we stop? But sadly, human beings aren't that rational. What does this war see by 1917, by the stage in which Ernie has arrived and has met his mate Chris, and they're beginning to get to grips with the really unpleasant fighting in Flanders around Ypres? You see a war where the British Army on the West has become the most important army of the Allies. You see a war where our artillery has expanded by 150-fold from 1914. You see a war of the nations all coming together in a peculiarly muddy place called Belgium. It must have been very confusing to the Indian troops to suddenly find themselves in the middle of Flanders. At least the New Zealanders would have recognised the rain and the grass. And you see a war which by 1917 has lost any of the illusions of the first couple of years, and which has become a grim grapple to the death, in which the two sides are half sluggishly thumping each other, desperately hoping the other will collapse. What about the New Zealand contribution to this war? Well, it's astounding. I looked carefully through my major historical records during the day, by which I mean Wikipedia, and it told me that the New Zealanders suffered 16,697 fatal casualties in this war, with a further 41,000 seriously wounded. And another 6,800 died directly of war wounds in the 5 years after the war. This is a terrible, terrible experience for a young and small nation. But bear in mind, New Zealand had a population of 1 million people. 1 million people. The only country that might, as a percentage, have lost more lives is actually Serbia. And as far as I know, Serbian record-keeping was a bit ropey, so who knows. This is an amazing sacrifice at the altar of empire. 42% of those who served died. Unbelievable. And when I saw a few years ago a British corporal returning from Afghanistan, and he appeared on TV, someone pressed a microphone on it, and they said, what was it like? And he said, oh, it was terrible, it was just like the Somme. I thought, bloody hell, read a few history books, mate. This is a terrible war. And the astonishing thing is that those people came to do that fighting as volunteers. I don't think we can really understand that. It gets me back to what I was saying about this being a hard war to actually understand the process in a rational, passionless way. Well, what does it do in many ways? And it would be nice to say war is unmitigatedly horrible, but it's not. It has virtues as it has horrors as well. So out of this war, what do you get? You get the birth of a new radicalism. Well, okay. Nasty totalitarian Marxism in the Soviet Union, some pretty nasty fascism and Nazism, but also the birth of the Labour movement as a mass movement, the birth of, in this country, a progressive party in the form of the Labour Party and its sister party in New Zealand. And for the first time, millions of people who saw the shackles on the way they lived their lives removed. You know, in one of the things that comes out in Murray's book is every now and then you meet a representative of the upper class, and they don't play well, really, do they?
And
that world dies in this war. The world of deference, the world of rigid inherited class, the world of insufferable division and gaps between rich and poor. I'm not saying it's gone away completely. I mean, that would be a ridiculous thing to say. But it's never an unchallenged world in the way it was before 1914. Also, this is a world which made men as well as broke them. Now, that people emerge from this war as broken as Ernie does. People emerge from this book enhanced and made, you know, richer in some horrible way by these experiences. Some of them went off and became poets, the swines. Very irritating. It's also a war that broke and created nations. Now, this is deeply bound up with New Zealand becoming a nation as opposed to a part of a wider British state. This is deeply bound up with other states disappearing. You know, look at the map of Europe in 1914 and, you know, you'd be amazed. I mean, it's quite amazing that some of those states have popped back. I never thought Montenegro would get back on the map, so who knows. It's also a war which saw the emergence of a new technology, of a new way of doing things in the world. It's also a war that left a generation of mutilated people as pensioners on the state. It is horribly complicated. It is horribly beyond us to understand, still as historians. And that's perhaps why the root of fiction, the root of creativity, is still the way in which most of us get to grips with this awfully complex and devastatingly unpleasant phenomena known as the First World War. Thank you.
Ian has kindly agreed to read some of the book, welcome.
Thank you.
And we're going to start by talking about they leave New Zealand. They were trained at Trentham Camp and Featherstone Camp in Wellington, and they arrive in England and arrive at a camp called Sling Camp. And Ian's going to start by reading a poem that the troops describe their conditions in Sling Camp.
Yeah, the New Zealand camp on Salisbury Plain. And when you turn from Sling Camp, there's an isolated spot I'd like to mention, where all you hear is stand at ease, quick march, slope arms, attention. It's miles from anywhere. By God, it's a rum un. A chap lived there for 50 years and never saw a woman. Lots of tiny little huts are dotted here and there. For those who have to live inside, I've offered many a prayer. It's sludge up to the eyebrows. By God, it is a puddle. Sandown wouldn't stand a dog's chance in the struggle. Soldiers live inside the huts. They fill my heart with sorrow. With tear-dimmed eyes, they say to me, it is Sling Camp tomorrow. Inside the camp, there's rats the size of nanny goats. Last night a soldier saw one trying on his overcoat. Each night you sleep on boards, just like a lot of cattle. Left to right or right to left, your bones begin to rattle.
And anyway, the training part of it took place before they went to Ypres. And they had a brief time of respite and they went to the beach.
A relief from training is swimming at Paris Plage. 25th of August, 1917. Dear Mum and Dad, they have let us out of camp to go swimming at a place called Paris Plage. A whole bunch of French girls followed us to the beach, carrying baskets of fruit and chocolates for sale. They were doing a good business, I can tell you. The girls stood about watching us as we stripped off and went into the water. There was a great deal of giggling and laughing and comment on our naked bodies. Altogether, it was like a scene from one of the Renoir paintings I saw in the National Gallery in London. The girls say they like us a lot better than the English, but perhaps they're only saying that because we get more pay than the Tommies. After a while, they took off their undergarments and went paddling in the water. One of our boys picked up a pair of pants and had a tug of war with its owner. In the struggle, it ripped in two, much to her annoyance and the amusement of all of us.
Remember, this is 1917, and this area had been fought over for 3 years, and what the condition was.
As they approach the front. Dear Mum and Dad, at last I can see and smell the war. Had I the words to describe the landscape before me? Passchendaele is a sort of hill or ridge. There are elevations that run from it. We are facing Gravenstaffel and Bellevue. The bogs around Invercargill are nothing to the swamps around here. I understand that shellfire has destroyed all the drainage system and the rainwater just sits on the top of the earth. The place is low-lying, but now is just one big bog because of all its drainage being gone. The noise is terrific. You cannot believe the unearthliness of it all. All thought and feeling disappears through the endless barrage of sound. Shells are dropping at my feet, but because of the mud, they bury themselves before doing any damage. My nose is full of the smell of explosive mixed with the odours from the putrid mud. Sometimes there is a poison gas shell among them. There are shells lands a short distance away from me, and I watch two men blown 15 feet into the air, spread-eagled like dummies. I see two other men so badly mutilated I could not describe them to you.
And so the preparation for the battle, the second battle of Passchendaele, and this is the description from Chris.
They were waiting to go over the top. First, there were the test shells going over their heads at infrequent intervals. Nothing, however, could have prepared them for the avalanche of sound that erupted behind them when all the guns opened fire. "God," said Chris, who was standing by Ernie, "someone's just opened the bloody gates of hell." "Fix bayonets!" The cry went down the trench. "We're in God's hands now, mate, if he bloody exists," Chris said to Ernie as they clambered out of the trench and followed the barrage. They immediately sank up to their knees in mud. This was the moment that the heavens opened and the steady drizzle turned into a deluge. "God help us if we go down in this stuff," Ernie thought, as he fought to keep his momentum going through the no-man's land they had to traverse. "We'll drown in this." The air crackled with bullets and explosions from shells. They were vaguely aware that some of them were falling silently around them, like the men on the newsreels of the Somme they had seen in Salisbury. Germans rose from the shell holes during the first 100 yards to their first objective, but offered no resistance, raising their hands in surrender. Ernie and Chris reached the first trench and found just one German crouching within it. "Go on, use your bayonet," someone on their right shouted. The German could hardly have been 16. His eyes bulged from his skull in terror. Ernie took the butt of his rifle and nudged the back of his head. Together, he and Chris lifted him out of the trench and pushed him back towards their lines. At that moment, a machine gun from one of the pillboxes opened up on them. An officer ran down the captured trench shouting orders. He saw that Ernie was carrying Mills bombs. "Right, soldier, take your bombs and go off there to the right and get behind the pillbox. The two of you," he said, pointing at Chris. Although the shelling had broken the wire, they had to still work their way carefully through it all the time, trying to avoid being spotted by the machine gunners in the pillbox. Together they navigated their way around to the rear of the machine gun nest. They were close enough to hear the machine gunners shouting at each other. Ernie's head now went into automatic pilot following the training at sling camp. He removed the firing pin from one of the bombs. It narrowly missed the opening, bounced off the concrete, and exploded outside the pillbox in a shower of mud. He wished he'd been as good a bowler as Albert. His near miss had alerted the machine gunners, who desperately sought to redirect their fire towards their attackers. Ernie removed the firing pin from another bomb. "This is for Albert," he said, as he threw it. And this time his aim was more accurate. For the rest of their lives, they both would remember the screams of the Germans inside. They were pleased there was a general push forward, and they did not have to see at first hand the carnage inside the pillbox. "Great work, men!" An officer came up beside them, breathing heavily. "And dead at 7 a.m. as well. We're on schedule." All he can do is talk about the time after all that, said Chris, when he was out of earshot. They spent that night in a shell hole, little more than a puddle in the ooze. Darkness merely heightened the nightmare surrounding them. They could hear some of those wounds, stumbling blindly around in the grim desolation. Many of the wounded were drowning in the putrid water at the bottom of the shell holes. Imaginary figures rose up before them, screaming threats in German. The wounded pleaded for help and relief from their suffering, while the dying called for their mothers. Any move from their shell hole would have invited a sniper's bullet. A rumour circulated among them that the Hun were about to counterattack using gas. There was an anxious fixing of gas masks. In the end, the effectiveness of the New Zealand artillery fire prevented a counterattack. Unfortunately, the absence of a counterattack persuaded the high command that the Germans were at the end of their tether. Quite the contrary. A crack regiment had been brought up into the line opposite the New Zealanders. Shortly after first light, a relief regiment of Canterbury's arrived. Tired beyond belief, Ernie and Chris began the trek out of the line. After about a mile, one of the duckboards collapsed under Chris and sent him sprawling into the mud that reached up to his waist. Ernie made as if to plunge into the mud himself after his friend. "For Christ's sake, Ernie, don't do that! Both of us will drown." The mud was like a quicksand, relentlessly dragging Chris under. Ernie desperately looked around for something he could throw to Chris to help him. About 20 yards away was a plank that a stray shell had broken off the walkway. "Hold on! Keep your bloody head above the mud!" Ernie shouted. By the time he returned with the plank, the mud was level with Chris's mouth. Ernie pushed the plank out, enabling Chris to pull his hands from the mud and hold it. Both then had to use what little reserves of strength they had after 2 days without sleep or food to lever him from the clutches of the mud. When Chris was on the walkway, they lay together for 10 minutes in utter exhaustion. "I don't think I've ever tasted anything worse than that in my life," said Chris, finally catching his breath. In the wilderness of dead bodies, dead horses, disabled tanks and wagons, they had just about enough energy to laugh.